date. A SAFT is a type of convertible note, or more generally, a forward contract. The SAFT itself is a financial security, irrespective of the classification of the token. Public token sales. Increasingly, public sales are avoided by those whose tokens may be classified a security. However, they are still popular with some projects due to their global reach, ease of fundraising, and hypeability. The project usually creates an Ethereum smart contract for receiving funds and displays the address on their website. Investors send money to the smart contract and receive tokens in a process automated by the smart contract or a series of smart contracts. To see an example of this, consult image 7.3 in the supplementary PDF. For some projects, the tokens may be ERC-20 compliant tokens recorded on the Ethereum blockchain. For others, especially projects that are creating new blockchain platforms, the tokens may be initially recorded as ERC-20 tokens on Ethereum to be redeemed later for tokens on the new blockchain when the new blockchain is up and running. Ethereum's own crowd sale accepted bitcoins as the funding currency and used a bitcoin address to receive the funds. Public sales tend to be well hyped. Countdowns and widgets displaying amounts raised are popular and often displayed prominently on the project's website. Social media, chat rooms, and bulletin boards are used to promote upcoming public sales. Token pre-sales. Pre-sales are the sale before the public sale, usually at a discounted price per token or with bonuses available to investors depending on the amount invested. They encourage investors to invest at a cheaper price and form part of the hype for an ICO. An oversubscribed pre-sale is a great psychological draw for investors in the main public sale. Whitelisting. Both public sales and pre-sales may have some address whitelisting as part of a project's efforts to identify their investors. Before the token sale, potential investors click through a series of web pages, declare their identity information, perhaps upload a picture of their passport, agree that they do not live in certain countries, accept terms and conditions, and provide the cryptocurrency address they intend to send funds from. During the actual token sale, the smart contract receiving funds will only accept funds from those cryptocurrency addresses that have been whitelisted. Funding caps. ICOs will declare funding caps in their white papers. These are floors and ceilings to the amount of funds the projects are willing to accept at any stage of the sales processes. A soft cap usually represents the minimum amount of funds needed for the project to go ahead, similar to Kickstarter's funding goal, and a hard cap usually represents the maximum the project will accept. Not every ICO will have a hard or soft cap, and some may change them according to demand. Treasury. Projects will often create more tokens than are sold in token sales, keeping some proportion behind in reserve. These reserves may be used to reward founders, pay staff or contractors, or to stabilize the price of the tokens on exchanges. The project may self-impose limits on how fast the reserves can be spent, a sort of vesting schedule, which offers investors some confidence that the project is not going to sell a large number of tokens held in treasury immediately after a sale and cause downward pressure on the price. Once a token is listed, the project will have some idea as to the value of the tokens they hold in treasury. In accounting terminology, these tokens are held on the company's balance sheet, and so they impact the equity valuation of the company. Shareholders, particularly venture capitalists, may like ICOs because they can create value on the company's balance sheet out of nothing. Exchange listing. Some investors may buy tokens at ICO to use the eventual product, service, or blockchain, but often investors want to make money by selling the tokens at a higher price than they bought them for. So, the ability to easily sell the tokens is important to investors. Although tokens are immediately transferable between people once they are assigned to investors, and therefore tokens may be bought and sold over the counter, the listing of the token on crypto asset exchanges is a key event in the lifetime of an ICO because exchanges make the tokens more liquid. The transferability of the token makes the token different from rewards-based crowdfunding, such as Kickstarter, where participants are not able to easily resell their rewards to others. Listings may be positive or negative for the price of the token, and price volatility can be high in the first few days of a token listing. If the project is popular, the listing can create an opportunity for new investors to accumulate the tokens, causing a rapid increase in price. If the project is unpopular, early investors may use the listing as an opportunity to sell their tokens, causing a rapid fall in price. Token listings are such an important event in the project that exchanges can charge projects significant amounts of money to list their token. Listing fees of over $1 million US are not uncommon. The exchange may also provide liquidity services, creating a market for the coins. When a token is listed, the project will monitor the price carefully, and some have strategies of buying tokens back when the price is low. The ethics and legality of this is a popular source of discussion. Traditional companies may issue shares when stock markets are high and perform share buybacks when prices are attractive. However, this is not an exact parallel of what happens in ICO land, and traditional companies may pay more attention to regulations about disclosure and trading activities. The number of exchanges, reputation of exchanges, and liquidity on those exchanges is important for the project and for investors. Investors prefer to see a token listed on multiple reputable exchanges with large numbers of customers and lots of liquidity. Despite the importance of exchange listing, projects tend to avoid discussing exchange listing timelines, especially those who are trying to keep their tokens from being classified as securities. This is because discussion of exchange listing adds weight to classification of the token as a security, since there is, arguably, more of an expectation of profit from investors. It's worth noting that while traditional stock exchanges impose requirements on the companies they list, such as periodic public disclosure of financials, crypto asset exchanges usually don't have such listing requirements, nor are the exchanges obligated to perform any due diligence on projects whose coins they are listing. Some cryptocurrency exchanges are happy to list any token, even those with a low likelihood of success, known colloquially as shitcoins, because the exchanges make revenues from trading fees, and so are indifferent to the quality of the project or the absolute value of the tokens they list. The exchanges make money as long as there is price volatility. When is a token a security? Earlier, we discussed that projects take different actions based on whether they think their token is or could be classified as a financial security. The classification of a token as a security is important as it impacts who can do what with the token, because activities relating to financial securities are regulated in most countries. Note that tokens themselves are not regulated, but activities related to them are. So how do we decide if a token may be classified as a security or not? In the USA, the Howey test is a well-known test that was created by the United States Supreme Court in 1946 during a case, SEC versus Howey. According to the Find Law website, in Howey, two Florida-based corporate defendants offered real estate contracts for tracts of land with citrus groves. The defendants offered buyers the option of leasing any purchased land back to the defendants, who would then tend to the land and harvest, pool, and market the citrus. As most of the buyers were not farmers and did not have agricultural expertise, they were happy to lease the land back to the defendants. The SEC sued the defendants over these transactions, claiming that they broke the law by not filing a securities registration statement. The Supreme Court, in issuing its decision, finding that the defendants' leaseback agreement is a form of security, developed a landmark test for determining whether certain transactions are investment contracts and thus subject to securities registration requirements. Under the Howey test, a transaction is an investment contract if 1. It is an investment of money. 2. There is an expectation of profits from the investment. 3. The investment of money is in a common enterprise. And 4. Any profit comes from the efforts of the promoter or third party. Although the Howey test uses the term money, later cases have expanded this to include investments of assets other than money. So, each token offering could be checked against the Howey test to determine whether the tokens qualify as investment contracts. If so, then under the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, those tokens are considered securities, and so activities relating to them are subject to certain requirements in the USA. In February 2018, the Swiss financial regulator, FINMA, issued guidelines saying that tokens can fall into one or more of the following categories, described here. 1. Payment tokens are synonymous with cryptocurrencies and have no further functions or links to other development projects. Tokens may, in some cases, only develop the necessary functionality and become accepted as a means of payment over a period of time. 2. Utility tokens are tokens which are intended to provide digital access to an application or service. And 3. Asset tokens represent assets such as participations in real physical underlyings, companies, or earnings streams, or an entitlement or dividends or interest payments. In terms of their economic function, the tokens are analogous to equities, bonds, or derivatives. FINMA suggests the following framework for determining whether a token is a financial security or not, and this seems reasonable in the current stage of industry development. To see a chart of this, consult image 7.4 in the supplementary PDF. In June 2018, William Hinman, Director, Division of Corporate Finance at the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, said in a speech, "Based on my understanding of the present state of Ether, the Ethereum network, and its decentralized structure, current offers and sales of Ether are not securities transactions. And as with Bitcoin, applying the disclosure regime of the federal securities laws to current transactions in Ether would seem to add little value." He differentiates the manner in which something, a token, is originally sold, and the later use and sale of the token. A token can have utility and also be offered as an investment contract, that is, a financial security. He explains, "The oranges in Howey had utility, or in my favorite example, the commission warned in the late 1960s about investment contracts sold in the form of whiskey warehouse receipts. Promoters sold the receipts to U.S. investors to finance the aging and blending processes of Scotch whiskey. The whiskey was real, and for some had exquisite utility, but Howey was not selling oranges, and the warehouse receipts promoters were not selling whiskey for consumption. They were selling investments, and the purchasers were expecting a return from the promoter's efforts." This means that, irrespective of what a token represents, the manner in which it is offered and the utility of the token at the time of offering is important. We will see over the coming years how this important speech impacts the manner in which ICOs are conducted. Conclusion. Although we're in the early stages of the token industry, we can see that it's already beginning to mature. In early ICOs, projects would write disclaimers in small print stating that the tokens are not an investment or a security, hoping that this would be enough to protect them. These investment rounds were sometimes described by the projects as donations or contribution rounds in order to dissociate with legally sensitive terminology. There was a clear disconnect between investor expectations of the tokens and the wording in the investor documents. Unfortunately for those with that view, wording matters less than the economic realities, as projects are finding out. To see a humorous analogy of this, consult image 7.5 in the supplementary PDF. In 2017, there was a wave of attempts to self-regulate and create industry standards. Projects trying to do the right thing looked for regulatory clarity. Today, the amount of money at stake is significant, and regulators and policymakers are catching up with token sales. This is a good thing for the maturity of the industry, as regulatory clarity can attract investment and allow projects the opportunity to focus on business rather than legal uncertainty. Regulators are now clarifying what they will and won't accept, and in light of clarifications, projects are moving to comply with or avoid regulation. Different regulators may take different approaches, creating opportunities for projects to select the most favorable operational jurisdictions. I'm looking forward to the next few years when more projects deliver products and we learn how to quantitatively put a value on tokens. The economics of tokens, or tokenomics, are yet to be fully described or understood. Part 8, Investing. In this section, I describe some considerations to help you decide whether investing in crypto assets is right for you. There are many risks, but the markets are exciting, and people have made and lost fortunes in these markets. Pricing. How do you put a value on cryptocurrencies or crypto assets? For tokens that are a claim on an underlying asset, such as 1 ounce of gold, the price of the token should more or less track the price of the underlying asset. However, as previously discussed, cryptocurrencies are not a claim on any asset, nor are they backed by an entity. Is there a way to calculate a fair value for them? We can ask 3 independent questions. 1. What is the current price of the crypto asset? 2. What causes prices to change? And 3. What should the price be? What is the current price of the crypto asset? The current price of any asset is determined by the market. Crypto assets trade on one or more exchanges, and both prices and liquidity can differ between exchanges. Exchanges that report the most trade volume provide a good measure of the price, as they are the most active and should have the most liquidity. Other exchanges may have higher or lower prices. CoinMarketCap.com is one of many websites that provide data about the current price of tokens and which exchanges they trade on. If you click on the name of a token and then click on Markets, you can see where that token trades and how much volume the exchange says it has traded. Note that some exchanges have been caught faking trade volume in order to generate business, and I am not confident this practice has been eliminated. Beware. What causes prices to change? The prices of cryptocurrencies and tokens behave like any other financial asset, driven by buyers and sellers who make trading decisions based on various factors. For example, 1. Sentiment, how traders feel about the asset. 2. Gossip and chatter on forums and social media sites. 3. Technical successes, for example, when blockchains successfully implement technical upgrades that make them more useful, or when an ICO makes progress on its roadmap. 4. Technical failures, for example, if transactions slow down or a weakness is found in the way the blockchain operates. 5. Celebrity endorsements, for example, Paris Hilton's endorsement of Lydian Coin in September 2017, and you can see a screenshot of her tweet as image 8.1 in the supplementary PDF, or John McAfee's occasional promotional tweets. 6. Founders getting arrested, for example, when the founders of Centra token were arrested in the USA, and the price of the tokens fell by 60%. 7. Orchestrated pump and dumps, where people coordinate to all buy a coin together to make the price go up and persuade others to buy it at a higher price, then sell the coins to unsuspecting new buyers. And 8. Manipulation by large holders of any particular token. What should the price be? There have been a number of attempts to create models to find a fair value for cryptocurrencies and tokens. A common but flawed model for putting a value on a Bitcoin is the "if the money in gold went into Bitcoin" model, meaning if X percent of the money in gold, or other asset class, moved into Bitcoin, a single Bitcoin should be worth Y dollars. The argument is as follows. The total value of gold in circulation is estimated at $8 trillion. If some small proportion of the people holding gold, say 5%, but you can use any number from 0 to 100% here, sold their gold for dollars, it would release a large amount of money, in this case, $400 billion. If the dollar proceeds were used to buy bitcoins, the total value of bitcoins in circulation, commonly referred to as market capitalization or market cap, would increase by the same amount, $400 billion. As we know the total number of bitcoins in circulation, 17 million or so, then this must increase the price of each bitcoin by $23,500. That's $400 billion divided by 17 million. But this logic is wrong. This is not how financial markets work at all. The money going into Bitcoin doesn't simply drop into the market cap. The reason is simple. When you buy $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, someone else is selling those Bitcoins for $10,000. So any money pumped in is also exactly equal to the money pumped out, excluding exchange fees, to keep things simple. The only thing that happens when you buy a Bitcoin is that the Bitcoin changes ownership and some cash changes ownership. There is no mathematical relationship between how much money you spend buying Bitcoins from someone else and the market cap of Bitcoin. Let's put numbers to this and demonstrate the flawed logic with a counterexample. Let's say the last price paid for Bitcoin was $10,000. So, the market cap of Bitcoin, assuming 17 million Bitcoin outstanding, is $10,000 times 17 million equals $170 billion. Now, let's say you want to buy a tiny amount of Bitcoin, say $10 worth, and the best price that you can see is $10,002. So you pay $10 and buy 0.0009998 Bitcoin. That's $10 divided by $10,002 per Bitcoin. What has happened to the market cap? It is now $10,002 times 17 million equals $170,034,000,000. The market cap has increased by $34 million just because of your measly $10 trade. You didn't pump in $34 million, but the market cap increased by that amount, so clearly, the earlier argument is wrong. Having said that, of course, if there are more buyers with a greater desire to buy and pay whatever it takes to accumulate bitcoins, then the prices will increase. Likewise, if there are sellers who will sell bitcoins at any price, then prices will fall. I also hear variations on cost of creation argument. For example, the price of Bitcoin should be at least the cost of mining them. So the cost of mining puts a floor under the price of Bitcoin. And as difficulty increases, it costs more to mine Bitcoins. So the price should rise. Alas, this is also false. The cost incurred by a miner, or even all the miners in aggregate, bears no relation to the market price of Bitcoin. The price of Bitcoin affects the profitability of miners. But there is no rule dictating that miners need to be profitable. If a miner is unprofitable, they will eventually stop mining, but this doesn't affect the price of bitcoins. If it costs me $5,000 to dig up 1 ounce of gold, this doesn't mean the price of gold should be at least $5,000 per ounce. User IHRHASE explains this with salmon and sauerkraut smoothies in a forum post in 2010. You can see a screenshot of this as image 8.2 in the supplementary PDF. Unfortunately, I have not yet come across a reasonable, fair value model for cryptocurrencies. ICO tokens should be easier to price. These tokens are redeemable for a certain good or service in the future, so putting a price on the token should be a case of figuring out what that good or service is worth, right? Alas, it is never that easy. The fact is that ICOs who issue tokens want the price of their tokens to go up, as do their investors. Redemption is always described generically and not quantified. For example, they say, tokens will allow you access to cloud storage, rather than, one token will give you 10 gigabytes of cloud storage for 1 year starting in 2020. This is a deliberate strategy. If the issuers quantified the goods or services, you could figure out an appropriate ballpark price for the token. But this would constrain the price, preventing the price of the token from massively increasing, which is really what ICO issuers and investors really want. I have never seen an ICO white paper quantify exactly what a token will be redeemable for. Who controls the price of utility tokens? The simple answer might seem to be the market or buyers and sellers, but this is not the full picture, as we have an issuer who can pull some tricks to affect the value of a token. Initially, the quantity of goods and services that the tokens can buy is unspecified, so the price of the token is subject to normal cryptocurrency market forces. And there is no way to do fundamental analysis on what a fair market price should be. You can't price cloud storage without quantifying how much for how long. During this period, some ICOs exert some influence on the price of their tokens by buying them up when the price falls. Some ICOs even discuss this strategy in their white papers. ICOs often retain a significant amount of tokens in their treasury, so they can sell some if the price rallies too aggressively. Essentially, they may act like a central bank of their tokens, managing the price. Later, there comes a point when the project has to make a decision. Do they set prices in fiat or in tokens? Should 1 gigabyte of cloud storage for 1 year cost $10, payable in tokens at market rate, or should 1 gigabyte of cloud storage for 1 year cost 1 token? Let's explore the options. 1. Priced in fiat, paid in tokens. If this is the case, then at first you'd think that the price of tokens should be irrelevant. Customers hold fiat, then, when they want to use the service, they buy the tokens, then quickly redeem them. This process could be automated, so the customer doesn't know what is going on in the background. This is the same argument that remittance by Bitcoin companies use when they say that the price of Bitcoin is irrelevant to their business. In this case, are tokens a good investment? Perhaps. As tokens are redeemed against the issuer, fewer and fewer of them exist in circulation, so long as the project does not reissue them and sell them for fiat to pay their staff. Fewer tokens may mean a higher price due to scarcity. So, a project in good financial health, not reliant on reselling redeemed tokens to pay their costs, can allow tokens to become more scarce over time, perhaps putting upwards pressure on their price. Perhaps. But a project in poor financial health will need to keep reselling their tokens to cover their costs. So actually, the financial health of the company may impact the pricing pressures on the token. 2. Priced in tokens, paid in tokens. This is wonderful. If the company sets the price of the goods or services in tokens, the company will have control over the value of their tokens, just as an airline controls the value of their air miles they issue. How does this work? Unless the product or service is unique, customers will have some idea about how much they are willing to pay for it. Imagine that a competitor sells a similar product for $10. If the project wants their tokens to be worth $10, then they set their product at a price of one token. If they want their tokens to be worth $20, then they set their product at a price of 0.5 tokens. The competitor's pricing helps to peg the token's price, and as long as the products are somewhat substitutable, the project can make their tokens worth whatever they want. They should understand that as they do this, their liabilities change. Their liabilities are the outstanding tokens in circulation, and by changing the price of one product from one token to 0.5 tokens, existing token holders can redeem tokens for twice as many products. If the company decides to price their product in tokens, are the tokens a good investment? Probably. The founders of the project, provided they haven't done a quick exit scam, also hold tokens and are financially incentivized to keep the price of tokens high and relatively stable. So, projects have more control over their token price if they price their services in tokens. And I would expect that, as projects come to maturity, we will see projects priced in tokens, providing that the projects haven't been shut down for violating securities regulations first. Anshuman Mehta attempted to price a fictional utility token on his blog and concluded that, in a fiat currency world, the market or traded price of the token is completely delinked with the usage and velocity of the token. Risks and mitigations. Market risk. Crypto asset prices are volatile and many have fallen to zero. At time of writing, deadcoins.com lists over 800 coins whose price has fallen to zero. I expect this number to increase. The price of any crypto asset can potentially fall to zero or near zero. This scenario may seem less likely for popular cryptocurrencies. Time, a significant hack, or exploited vulnerability could cause a fatal loss of confidence in the asset at any time. Liquidity risk. Liquidity risk is the risk that the market cannot support your transaction at the price you expect. Liquidity comes and goes, as with all markets. Less popular coins are less liquid, meaning that a large buy or sell can move the market against you more than expected. With less popular coins or coins of regulatory uncertainty, there is also a risk that they are delisted by exchanges, which reduces their liquidity. For example, in May 2018, Poloniex announced that they were delisting 17 tokens. You can see a screenshot of their tweet as image 8.3 in the supplementary PDF. Exchange risks. It's convenient to keep assets on exchanges because you don't have to deal with private keys and you can quickly trade between assets. However, exchanges have had an extremely poor track record of keeping customer assets secure. Nearly all exchanges have been hacked in the past. Michael Matthews published a list of a selection of cryptocurrency exchange hacks between 2012 and 2016, and you can see this list as image 8.4 in the supplementary PDF. From this analysis, we can see not only that exchanges have been successfully hacked by external parties, but it's not unknown for staff at exchanges to steal cryptocurrencies from their customers. On his website, Blockchain Graveyard, Ryan McGeehan manages a list of security breaches and thefts with their causes based on public information. The root cause analysis shows that there are multiple ways for exchanges to be hacked. For a graph of this, consult image 8.5 in the supplementary PDF. Being hacked is an existential threat to exchanges, so the top exchanges take security extremely seriously. Nevertheless, prudence suggests that you should use exchanges only when necessary, and to withdraw funds as soon as possible after trading. Only keep as much on an exchange as you are willing to lose. Exchanges and users of exchanges may also engage in illegal or unethical activity. Tricks borrowed from the wholesale financial markets industry include 1. Painting the tape, meaning artificially increasing trading activity by having parties controlled by the exchange repeatedly trade with each other. This fake volume encourages other customers to trade. 2. Spoofing, meaning submitting orders with the intention of canceling them before they are matched. This trick can be used to drive prices up or down. 3. Front running. Here, an exchange can see a customer order and use the information to trade before the customer's order is accepted. 4. Running stops. Here, a certain type of customer order, called a stop loss, is not visible to other customers of the exchange, but is visible to the exchange. Insiders who can see customer stop loss orders can use this information to trade against their own customers. This is a popular trick in FX markets. And 5. Fake liquidity, meaning exchanges can publish unfillable orders that disappear or only partially fill when a customer tries to match them. This makes it look like there is more liquidity on the exchange than there actually is. There are many other tricks that may be used either by exchanges or by customers of exchanges while the management of the exchange looks the other way. Different exchanges behave with different levels of professionalism. Many exchanges are dodgy. Do your own research. Wallet risks. With wallets, there is a trade-off between security and convenience. Wallets that run online on computers or smartphones are convenient because it's easy to make cryptocurrency payments. However, storing private keys on a device exposed to the internet is not advised. Some people keep a small amount of cryptocurrency on their phone wallet so they can make payments instantly, but the advice, again, is to keep only as much in them as you are willing to lose. In the past, it was common for people to print private keys on bits of paper, a technique known as cold storage, discussed previously, but this is troublesome for making payments. Now, hardware wallets are the best compromise between security and convenience, but the risk remains with any wallet type that the software contains bugs or vulnerabilities that can be exploited. Many wallets open source their code to allow developers and security professionals to understand exactly how the wallet works and to take comfort that there are no weaknesses. But this also provides transparency to hackers. Regulatory risks. Regulation around cryptocurrencies and tokens is evolving. It's worth understanding as fully as possible the nature of the assets you are considering. ICOs are operating in a legal gray area in many jurisdictions, and there is a risk that some are deemed to have been illegally performing regulated activities. Depending on the jurisdiction and classification of crypto assets and what you are doing with them, tax also needs to be considered. You are not excused from complying with tax regulations just because the assets are recorded on blockchains. Scams. Finally, due to the nature of the cryptocurrency industry, many scams operate. Hype, technical complexity, regulatory uncertainty, and naive investors hoping to make a quick buck all make for an environment ripe for fraudsters. Some popular scams are 1. Ponzi schemes. Investors are promised good returns and old investors are paid with new investors' money. 2. Exit scams. Founders of a project, wallet, exchange, or investment scheme run off with customer money. 3. Fake hacks. The project gets hacked by an associate who shares profit with the project team. 4. Pump and dumps. Illiquid coins are bought cheaply by fraudsters, then hyped on social media and sold at a higher price to new investors. 5. Scam ICOs. The ICO raises money with no intention of delivering a product. Sometimes they will list well-known industry experts as advisors or as part of the team to get credibility without the knowledge or approval of the expert. 6. Spoof ICOs. These are clones of real ICO websites made with the scammer's deposit address instead of the legitimate deposit address. 7. Scam mining schemes. These are claims that investors will earn lots of cryptocurrency, but key information, such as difficulty increases, is not disclosed. And 8. Fake wallets. This is wallet software that allows the scammer to access private keys so the coins can be stolen from the user. And so on. There are many variations to these, and scammers are proving increasingly innovative. I hope this chapter has given you some food for thought. People have made and lost fortunes trading cryptocurrencies and investing in ICOs, but there are many risks. If you do decide to get involved, be careful and do a lot of research before committing your money. Part 9. Conclusion. Conclusion. In this book, I set out to explain the basics of bitcoins and blockchains, and I hope that it has been easy to follow. At the very least, I have provided some ideas about concepts and terms for you to research further, and perhaps ignited a curiosity that you may not have had before. Amid the hype, it's important to understand that the blockchain industry, including cryptocurrencies, business blockchains, and tokenization of assets, is very much in its infancy. Two important things seem to have been created. One, new censorship-resistant financial assets, methods of value transfer and transparent automation. And two, new technologies for business-to-business data and asset transfer. We can call these, respectively, a crypto story and a blockchain story. The crypto story. Public blockchains are creating a new wave of censorship-resistant digital assets and unstoppable automated computations. For the first time in history, people can transfer value electronically worldwide without needing specific third parties to approve the transaction. Payments can be sent to transparent smart contracts that guarantee certain outcomes without manual steps or needing to trust a third party to do what they have promised. Public blockchains are being explored for a wide range of uses, from online micropayments through to remittances, fundraising, and record keeping. The blockchain story. Businesses are investing in private and public blockchains to see if they can reduce costs and risks, increase revenues, or create new business models. Private blockchains are a more recent idea than public blockchains, and are rapidly evolving and improving. These multi-party database systems promise to remove duplicative processes and allow digital assets and records to move freely between businesses, reducing reliance on expensive intermediaries. The future. Are these blockchains a bubble or a fad? In my view, no. Both public and private blockchains have their roles and will continue to evolve and deliver in ways we might not even be able to envisage today. In the public cryptocurrency industry, innovation will continue to accelerate as tokens create financial incentives that attract developers and other staff. The speed and intensity of innovation will increase if popular crypto assets increase in price. Many developers personally hold cryptocurrencies and tokens, and so are directly financially incentivized to make their projects successful, even more so than staff at traditional startups, who often only have a tiny sliver of equity. We will continue to see the tokenization of assets, products, and services. Computer game items are a good candidate for this. Imagine being able to own the unique sword that a famous gamer used to defeat an opponent. Imagine owning the signed digital football that was used in an esports World Cup final. or owning the digital shirt that a popular character wore during the match. There is an entire market of digital collectibles that will be opened up. The confluence of e-gaming and crypto assets is going to create some extremely exciting opportunities and new markets. Esports and crypto assets are a trend, not a fad, and it would be unwise to bet against them. ICOs will continue to be popular, and the industry will begin to standardize with best practices and common investor expectations. Perhaps one day we might figure out a way to value tokens. Regulations will become more clear, and this will enable those currently on the sidelines to participate. Whether Bitcoins, Ether, or other cryptocurrencies become more price stable or not, we will see crypto assets that have a stable price with respect to fiat currencies. We can call these stable coins, or crypto fiat. Fiat currency, or a near equivalent, will be tokenized and recorded on blockchains. Whether these crypto fiat tokens are best issued by central banks, e-money businesses, or somehow managed by smart contracts is still to be determined. There are a number of initiatives to create these price-stable tokens on both public and private blockchains. Stable crypto assets will enable another cycle of innovation. However, public blockchains are suffering growing pains as they grow in transaction volume and throughput. In recent years, both Bitcoin and Ethereum have had periods of stress where miners couldn't process transactions quickly enough, causing backlogs. Engineers are working on solutions to these problems, and concepts such as sharding and state channels can allow public blockchains to scale. Forks and chain splits will become more problematic due to the confusion that they create. Which is the real blockchain and which is the fork? Proof of work is energy intensive and is polluting the planet. Ethereum may move from proof of work to proof of stake, a much less energy intensive block writing mechanism. And if successful, other blockchains may follow suit. As the amount of value recorded on blockchains increases, governance will too become increasingly important. Platforms with no formal governance may not be acceptable to some users. A public ledger called Hedera Hashgraph is experimenting with having a formal governance structure over a public and accessible distributed ledger. Private blockchains will be adopted by businesses, perhaps first in small groups for specific uses, and then, sooner or later, they will come together to form larger networks, just as the internet was formed from individual private networks. Assets and records represented digitally will change ownership at the speed of email with fewer steps and costs. We will learn how to use this technology to move documents across organizational boundaries, for example, invoices, purchase orders, packing lists, certificates of origin, certificates of guarantee, health records, rental agreements, the list goes on. These documents are assets that can all be represented as tokens on distributed ledgers with much stronger authenticity guarantees due to the use of digital signatures. Many digital documents should only be represented once, with the right parties having visibility into the latest version. Whether between or within organizations, when data sets need to be passed from one system to another, the receiving system needs to be confident that it has the complete set of data and the data hasn't been corrupted in the process. This situation happens a lot in banking. Often huge lists of trades need to be sent from one system to another. Often there is a process called a control process that reconciles the data between the sending and receiving system. This reconciliation is yet another process that needs to be set up and monitored. But if the trades can be recorded and sent with a reference, a hash, to a previous trade in the set, then the receiving system can know for sure both that it has the complete set of trades and that the data within the trades has not been altered by accident or malice. This means that a receiving system may be confident about the completeness and accuracy of data received without performing a reconciliation against the sending system. In the future, it will make little sense to manage any document or dataset that needs to cross organizational boundaries using anything other than a blockchain. These improvements will increase the velocity of business done within countries and across borders. This has a huge impact, not only for the financial services industry, which is mostly about the movement of assets, but also for the real economy. Smart contracts will enable business-to-business automation in a guaranteed way that hasn't been possible before. Automation has tended to stop at the boundaries of businesses, with each business checking that the other one has performed according to the rules of the particular deal. With smart contracts, these rules can be automated and validated automatically, so duplicative processes can be made much more efficient, even eliminated. Blockchains enable atomic transactions, transactions that make multiple changes to the ledger simultaneously or not at all. Atomic, because the changes are bundled together and indivisible. If two banks are engaging in a trade, perhaps one is buying a bond from another, two things happen. The bond changes ownership, and the cash changes ownership. These transactions currently occur on separate ledgers, and one leg can fail while the other succeeds. This creates an operational risk that can lead to financial disaster. On a blockchain, an atomic transaction can be created that includes both changes of ownership, the cash and the bond. That transaction is committed in its entirety. It either succeeds as a whole or fails. In finance, this concept is called delivery versus payment. And historically, we have paid agents to guarantee this. Blockchain technology now provides the technological means to do this. This itself has the capacity to make entire business ecosystems operate more smoothly with less risk, while removing the need to pay third parties to perform the escrow service. There are some potential uses for special purpose money, for example, grants or charity contributions that may legitimately end up in only certain pre-agreed accounts. This has social and economic implications, and we'll need to learn how to use these tools ethically. At first, private blockchains will be used to do the same kind of business as today, but better, faster, and cheaper. They will improve how businesses interact. Later, there will be a shift, and industries will start to evolve their processes. They will improve what businesses do. Intermediaries who were once necessary will be sidestepped, and their business models made irrelevant. This will drive down transaction costs and return value to the real economy. This will follow a similar curve to the adoption of desktop computers in business in the 1980s. First, they were used to automate existing processes for individuals. Then people began to see a whole new world of potential opening up. The financial services industry is particularly at risk of disruption from this technology. Before blockchains, third-party intermediaries were needed to keep track of digital assets. The ledger containing your money is controlled by your bank. The ledger containing your shares is in the hands of your share custodian. You've never been able to digitally own and directly control a financial asset. It has always been kept by a third party. The financial services industry is full of intermediaries who hold your assets. They are the ones who keep track of who owns what, and it's their job to prevent double spending. And they are rewarded handsomely for doing so, a cost you bear. However, with crypto assets, you really can hold and control your assets, though this has its risks. The blockchain is the ledger. This technology must result in fewer intermediaries. And that's probably a good thing overall. Fewer financial intermediaries means fewer businesses that extract profit from the real economy. There is a possibility that the distinction between public and private blockchains fades away, or that assets can jump between one blockchain and another with such ease that the blockchains themselves become a matter of preference and matter as little as which device you use to check your email. We have already seen the start of disintermediation. In ICOs, huge sums of money are being transferred around the world without a bank in sight. In June 2016, I, personally, helped to arrange the custody of almost 25,000 bitcoins seized as proceeds of crime, worth 16 million Australian dollars at the time. The bitcoins were held in custody by EY, a professional services firm, for a month before being transferred to winners of a global auction. No bank was paid. No bank needed to be paid. Financial intermediaries are scrambling to adopt blockchain technology to figure out how they can evolve their business models to work in the new environment. Far-sighted companies at risk of disruption are already jostling for a position to adopt new roles in the new ecosystem. Whether you are a proponent of public blockchains or private, whether you believe in the long-term viability of specific cryptocurrencies or not, and whether you think that decentralization is a good thing or not, this industry is certainly delivering for society the most interesting and potentially radical instruments of change. Whether these tools will be used for good or bad depends on how the technology is adopted, by whom, and for what purpose. Appendix. The Fed. The Federal Reserve is not a single central bank. It is a central banking system. The system is comprised of three main parts: 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, the Federal Reserve Board, and the Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC. According to Wikipedia, the Federal Reserve System is composed of several layers. It is governed by the presidentially appointed Board of Governors or Federal Reserve Board, the FRB. 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, located in cities throughout the nation, oversee the privately owned U.S. member banks. Nationally chartered commercial banks are required to hold stock in the Federal Reserve Bank of their region, which entitles them to elect some of their board members. The FOMC sets monetary policy. It consists of all 7 members of the Board of Governors and the 12 regional bank presidents, though only 5 bank presidents vote at any given time. The president of the New York Fed and 4 others who rotate through 1-year terms. People talk about the big Fed and the little Feds. When they talk about the big Fed, they are usually talking about either the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, the Board of Governors, or the FOMC. The little Feds are the 12 regional Federal Reserve banks. Big Fed, Board of Governors. According to the St. Louis Fed, the Board of Governors guides the Federal Reserve's policy actions and consists of up to 7 governors appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. As of June 2018, there are only 3 governors guiding the Fed. Federal Open Market Committee. The FOMC is the body that raises or lowers interest rates. The St. Louis Fed describes the committee as the Fed's chief body for monetary policy. Its voting membership combines the 7 members of the Board of Governors, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and 4 other Reserve Bank presidents who serve 1-year terms on a rotating basis with the other Reserve Bank presidents. According to the Chicago Fed, the monetary policy goals of the Federal Reserve are to foster economic conditions that achieve both stable prices and maximum sustainable employment. What does a stable price mean? The target goal for the FOMC is to set monetary policy to create a 2% per year CPI. 2% seems small but has a significant effect over a lifetime. The maximum stable employment rate is targeted at 95.4% employment, or 4.6% unemployment. The FOMC oversees and sets policy on open market operations, the principal tool of national monetary policy. The committee meets 8 times a year, approximately once every 6 weeks. As of June 2018, out of a maximum of 12 voting members, only 8 committee members were appointed. Little Feds. The Little Feds are the 12 separately incorporated regional Federal Reserve banks, known as regional FRBs. They are based in the cities of Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Richmond, Atlanta, Chicago, St. Louis, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Dallas, and San Francisco. You can see an illustration of the territories of the Little Feds as image 10.1 in the supplementary PDF. The regional FRBs are responsible within their territory for supervising and examining state member banks, lending to depository institutions, providing key financial services, for example, interbank payment systems, and examining certain financial institutions. They also provide the U.S. government with a ready source of loans and serve as the safe depository for federal money. The regional FRBs are not part of the federal government of the USA, but are set up like private corporations, according to the St. Louis Fed. The shareholders are banks from the private banking sector, who receive a tax-free 6% dividend from the regional FRBs in any year that the regional FRB makes money. In fact, nationally chartered banks must purchase some amount of this stock, with the amount based on their size. It's nice to be a bank and be forced to own the central bank and receive guaranteed dividends risk-free. If you look at image 10.2 in the supplementary PDF, you can see the diagram that shows how it all fits together today. This has been a Podium audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we'd love for you to rate and review it. You can check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Discord. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to The Basics of Bitcoins and Blockchains, produced by Troy Oatey, executive producer Greg Lawrence, written by Anthony Lewis, performed by Sean Pratt, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Text copyright 2018 by Anthony Lewis. Production copyright 2020 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.